have is Curtis Benjamin Harrell III versus Commonwealth of Virginia, Megan Shapiro for the appellant, and both Mary Virginia Bourne, the appellate. Good morning, counsel.
Good morning.
How much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
I would like to reserve 5 minutes, please, Your Honor.
All right. You may proceed when ready.
A man is falsely accused of a crime. He learns that the police made two separate recordings of the alleged crime, but instead of providing the recordings to the man, they erase them both. Now, the man has no way of knowing what was actually captured on those tapes beyond two things. First, the tapes did not inculpate him, and he knows this because he knows that he is innocent. And two, those tapes would have been the best evidence of his innocence. Now, if the due process doctrines of Brady, Trombetta, and Youngblood cannot offer this man a remedy, then they're utterly useless, and that cannot be the intention of the justices who issued those rulings, nor of the drafters of the 14th Amendment itself.
Ms. Shapiro, help me with this. I understand your point that he thinks that they were exculpatory because he knew he was innocent, but couldn't the defendant in Trombetta and Youngblood have said the same thing? I knew I wasn't drunk. That breath sample would have shown that. Or I knew I wasn't the culprit in Youngblood, the semen samples would have exonerated me. I don't see how you distinguish those cases.
Your Honor, I'd like to, because ultimately, we are asking for a correction of the Gavilonia precedent in this court, and I understand that this panel cannot do that.
They can relate acknowledgement.
We could recommend that the court do that.
And so
that wasn't.
I appreciate that.
I want to get to that in a second.
Yes.
Can you answer my question about Trombetta and Youngblood?
Now, the question of whether these tapes were apparently exculpatory versus potentially exculpatory, and I think that the briefs lay out our best arguments for meeting both of those standards. The record in this case, Your Honor, I apologize. There's several different reasons why the tapes in this case should be looked at as exculpatory evidence. No matter which standard you're using, the potentially exculpatory standard, the apparently exculpatory standard, or the material standard of Brady itself. First, I think looking to the nature of the tapes themselves. This is a video of the alleged crime itself. There's no question that is absolutely a material piece of evidence. It would have been the only direct evidence of who was driving in this case. And there were two separate videos. The record establishes that the officers taking the videos had a clear view of what they witnessed, a car driving perpendicularly across their point of view.
Let me ask you this question,
yes,
though, in terms of what the video would have shown. This is body-worn camera video, which apparently was on the officer's shoulder, correct?
Yes, sir.
They were inside the vehicle at the time. Do we know exactly what the video would have shown above the dashboard, if you will, into the street where apparently they claimed they saw your client?
What the record does tell us is that they had a clear view. There were two different camera angles, given that there were two separate recordings being taken. It was a sunny day. The windows of the passing car were open. And I understand what Your Honor is getting at with your question.
When they say they had a clear view, they're referring to their line of sight, not necessarily the line of sight that might have been seen from the shoulder.
Yes. I understand what you're getting at, and there's another reason why those videos would have been material and exculpatory for Mr. Harrell, and that is that they would have provided valuable rebuttal and impeachment evidence. Whether or not they could actually capture the view of the officers in that precise moment when the car was passing their field of view, which I would argue there's plenty of reason to presume that that at least one of those tapes would have captured that. But even that aside, there was no identification of Mr. Harrell offered by either officer in their testimony. As argued by defense counsel at trial, the videos would have been an objective way to counter the testimony of the officers. Because not only would it have countered the officers' implied ID, because they didn't make an actual ID of Mr. Harrell, but the videos also would have captured the length of time that the officers lost sight of the vehicle before they found it parked on the road, as well as how long it took between finding the parked car and seeing Mr. Harrell. And that would have undercut the relevance of the officer's observations that Mr. Harrell was out of breath when they approached him.
Ms. Shapiro, I understand your argument, but I'm having trouble saying how this is different from what the Supreme Court said in Prieto, where it said evidence obtained by the police prior to the identification of a suspect under some circumstances may be inculpatory or exculpatory, and whether it is exculpatory cannot be determined until a comparison can be made with an identified suspect. So, and then the court goes on to say such evidence is potentially exculpatory and not apparently exculpatory. Isn't that right?
In Prieto, the evidence at issue was a hair that was found and had not been scientifically analyzed. The defense wanted to analyze that for as potentially exculpatory evidence. In this case, Your Honor, we are arguing that the videos are of a different nature and character, that the evidence of this case puts them in a different light. The proffer
but you can't
here...
But you can't be sure that it would have been exculpatory. You just don't know because you haven't seen the video.
I can't deny that, Your Honor. But the proffer, as to me personally...
Shapiro,
is there
any evidence in the record that the police thought that the evidence was exculpatory when they deleted the tape?
Now, that's an interesting question because, of course, the relevant question is whether it was apparently exculpatory from the perspective of the police officers. The police officers in this case, as I said, could not identify Mr. Harrell. They did not identify him.
That wasn't my question. My question was, is there any evidence in the record that the police thought the tape was exculpatory?
The evidence in the record that the police thought or should have understood that the tape was exculpatory is that they knew that they could not identify Mr. Harrell from where they were sitting when they saw the event take place.
Okay, that seems like your inference and not evidence in the record.
Well, the second piece of evidence in the record, Judge, is a proffer, that was made by defense counsel in which it was said, quote, regarding the destruction of these tapes. That is an extreme source of distress for my client because he is confident and adamant that that would have demonstrated his innocence in this matter.
As I said earlier, the defendant could have said the same thing in Trombetta and Youngblood.
All I can say, Judge, is that on the record of this case, in this situation, I cannot fathom what more could be required of someone falsely accused of a crime who has no possible way of knowing what was on tapes recorded by the police and then destroyed by the police.
Can I go back to your suggestion that Gagliano be overruled? That's an earlier decision than Prieto. Do you read the two as inconsistent? Does Prieto have the right standard?
Prieto I believe that the invitation was to apply a Youngblood standard. I'll say this. No, I don't think that Prieto changed the doctrine of this court. I think that Prieto is applying the doctrine and does not have as detailed an analysis or discussion as Gagliano.
I don't think Prieto cites Gagliano, which is a Court of Appeals case. Prieto is a Supreme Court of Virginia case.
You're not
saying Prieto's wrong, are you?
I don't. That's not our argument, no. I believe that Prieto is solidly holding that the Trombetta standard would not have applied in Prieto, but is applying the Trombetta standard. And no, you're correct now that you mentioned it. It does not cite Gagliano.
So assume for argument's sake we were to agree with you that Gagliano misspoke or got the analysis slightly wrong, would we really need to overrule it, or would we just need to say, you know, Prieto set it straight a year later?
I do not believe that Prieto engages in that analysis. So my answer to your question is that I don't believe that can be avoided revisiting Gagliano.
Your argument for why Gagliano is wrong is what? That it doesn't require bad faith for the destruction of exculpatory evidence? What's your argument for why it's wrong?
Gagliano combines the two tests. Gagliano requires not only that evidence, that the defense showed that evidence is apparently exculpatory, as opposed to merely potentially exculpatory, but also requires the defense show that there has been bad faith. And that is the misapplication of the doctrine.
So if we think that you haven't demonstrated here that the evidence was apparently exculpatory, then we actually don't need to reach that question, do we?
That may be true, Your Honors, and we do lay out an argument as to how we meet the young blood potentially exculpatory test in our briefing.
I'm sorry, last question. Is there any other evidence of bad faith other than what you described as your inference?
I would like to, yes, Your Honor. The short answer is yes. And I much appreciate that. I'll answer this question very briefly, and then I'll reserve. The Commonwealth attempts to argue that those tapes were not destroyed, that they were destroyed before the issuance of a discovery order by the circuit court. But that is demonstrably not true from the record. And when I look back on the record with fresher eyes in preparation for this argument, it stood out to me so clearly, and I just want to make sure we set the record straight here as to the order of those events, because it is relevant to bad faith, as well as to the discovery and Brady claims in this appeal. But the discovery motion is filed in August. The Commonwealth responds in October, promising to disclose the tapes. The discovery order is issued a few days after that, also in October, in November, requiring disclosure of the tapes. In November, the trial is actually continued on the basis of the tapes not having yet been disclosed. Which I believe is on a joint motion of both parties. And so clearly the Commonwealth is, at least the prosecutors, of the belief that the tapes are forthcoming. And then it's not until December that the Commonwealth learns that the tapes have been destroyed and is told, as they put it, quote, relaying what the police apparently told the prosecutor about the destruction, quote, what their belief was is that it had been 13 months and hadn't been properly preserved, so it was deleted. That is also evidence of bad faith in this case, in addition to all of the regulations that are listed in the brief. Appreciate it.
I want to follow up real quickly on this point of bad faith.
Yes.
You seem to suggest, and Youngblood requires the showing of bad faith, that there is evidence of bad faith, and I'm struggling to see how you get to argue that today when trial counsel specifically waived it on 269. He said there was no bad faith. He's very clear in that. He said, I'll just tell you, sir, as an officer of the court judge, I don't have anything to support but anything that Mr. Donaher or the officers or anyone associated with the Commonwealth or the police department did anything whatsoever in bad faith. That is not my assertion, not in any way whatsoever. So how can you approbate and reprobate here today if the trial there was no argument that there was bad faith? How can you take that position today?
There's a distinction here. That was an argument that was being made by counsel. There was no legal argument at the time being made by counsel that the failure to follow regulation can satisfy the, quote, bad faith standard of the Youngblood doctrine. There's a separate way to establish the bad faith standard of Youngblood, and that is by failure to follow regulations. That is not the argument that was being made or being addressed by counsel. He was acknowledging that he did not have evidence of personal ill will, personal bad faith, and we have acknowledged in our briefing that the argument, the alternative bad faith basis of failure to follow regulations, is not preserved in this record. But this is not a situation of approbating and reprobating, because that legal position was not before the trial court, was not being discussed by the parties.
When you refer to policy, you're referring to the Chesapeake Police Department policy as it relates to the preservation of the evidence?
I'm referring to the public regulatory policy published by the police department, the regulations that are published by the agency of the Library of Virginia and the Virginia Code.
Which was not provided to the trial court.
That's correct. The argument was not preserved in the trial court.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. All right, Ms. Boyne.
May it please the court, Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the appellee, the Commonwealth of Virginia. No amount of passion or belief can change what the record is in this case and what the arguments that were made below to the trial court and the arguments that were not made. Here, the issues that were not preserved that were arguments that were made on brief. One, that the Gaglionia improperly collapsed the tests of Trombetta and Youngblood. That argument was not presented to the trial court and is waived. The argument that the evidence was apparently exculpatory at the time the police destroyed, or rather failed to preserve, because as we know, this was evidence that was automatically destroyed by the software in this case, and they failed to preserve it, but there was no testimony or other evidence, or frankly, any specific argument that it was apparently exculpatory at the time it was destroyed. That argument is not preserved. Because the trial counsel made the following statement. He said, that is, it was potentially useful, but we don't know because it is no longer with us. That is on page, I believe, 213 of the joint appendix, and that is a concession that he is not arguing that the court should find it was apparently exculpatory, but was instead arguing it was potentially useful.
Moreover, I'm not sure we need to reach the question about whether Gaglione should be overruled, but going back to your argument on waiver, I mean, the trial court can't change the rule in Gaglione. It's bound by it. I mean, our court on bank could change it. We could overrule it. Where is there a case that stands for the proposition that if you're going to argue for overruling a precedent, you have to raise that in the trial court?
Well, I think that certainly the argument has to be that it is an improper, that the legal standard that was argued was improper. I mean, I think that that does have to be preserved.
I want to focus on the question of whether a controlling authority has to be overruled. It's not obvious to me why that should have to be raised in the trial court, since the trial court has no power to overrule it.
Well, I think that the issue is not whether or not it should be overruled, but whether or not it is the correct standard. And that
there are different pieces of the puzzle here. I want to really focus just on the issue of the case being overruled. Is there a precedent that says that if you're going to argue for overruling a Court of Appeals case or a Supreme Court of Virginia case, you have to raise that argument in the trial?
No, I'm not aware of any precedent that says that exact thing. But my point is that the argument that there was an incorrect standard being applied was not made.
Okay. And I asked your friend on the other side earlier, if we conclude that the evidence here does not support a showing that the destroyed evidence was apparently exculpatory, we don't need to reach the question whether Gaglione should be overruled. Do you agree with that?
Yes, and one of the reasons I absolutely agree with that, and I think that was the argument I made on brief, I think that the other issue is that both Gaglione and Kumar, which were two cases that were cited by opposing counsel, both decided both prongs, even though, regardless of whether the test was stated incorrectly in the conjunctive, and there is certainly case law from other jurisdictions which I have cited that it's not a novel proposition to consider it in the conjunctive. But nonetheless, I would argue that the court does not need to reach that, but that in both of those cases, both prongs were found. So those cases were not incorrectly decided, and they don't need to be overruled because both prongs were found. So under either measure, both were correctly decided. Moving back to my argument, the bad faith, the argument that it was destroyed in bad faith was not preserved in the trial court. And worse than not being preserved, not only that it wasn't preserved, but actually there is an affirmative statement that he is not making that argument, that he is not arguing that it was destroyed in bad faith. And therefore, it's approbate and reprobate. And there is no ends of justice under Brittle to circumvent and approbate and reprobate. And that, and there are good policy reasons for that, because the trial court at that point doesn't have to reach that issue. He's being told, look, I'm not making this argument. I'm conceding this. So how can the trial court be reversed for not taking up an argument that the defendant has said he is not making?
Ms. Park, can I ask you about something? This is maybe from left field, but in 2019, the General Assembly added a provision to Title 801. It's 801-379.2:1, providing rules for determining the effect of spoliation of evidence. I don't know if you're familiar with the statute. My first question is, can you tell me, if you know, how do the constitutional rules compare to the spoliation rules?
And I remember reading something about this when I was doing the research in this case. It wasn't squarely before me in the briefing, so I don't really want to speak out of turn. I mean, I'm happy to do some follow-up briefing if the court would like me to do that. I don't think that that spoliation equates with the constitutional requirements of Trombetta and Youngblood.
Yeah. I mean, the statute requires some form of misconduct on the part of the party that spoliates the evidence.
Correct.
Because it correlates loosely with the bad faith requirement. But it also considers possible discovery sanctions short of dismissal. In this case, did the defendant argue for anything short of dismissal?
No, I don't believe he did, and I don't believe that that specific code section was cited or that particular argument was made, and it was, they would therefore would have been waived as, in addition to the other arguments. I mean, he did argue under the rule that it should be dismissed under the discovery rule, but with regard to, but as I've argued before, when you look at the trial court, court's comments regarding that, regarding the 3A11 argument. The trial court is specifically saying that I believe that the trial court, you know, did not make a specific ruling on the Rule 3A11 argument. What the trial court is saying is, yeah, there was an allegation of discovery, and immediately talks about Youngblood versus Trombetta. It's very clear that what the trial court believed the argument to be was a Youngblood-Trombetta argument and nothing more. There was no specific argument about Rule 3A11 and any of the sanctions that are available under that statute. Of course, as we know, the trial court has a panoply of options to deal with a discovery violation. And dismissal is really the atomic option. Here, there's no evidence of bad faith, so it wouldn't have been an abuse of discretion for the court to refuse to dismiss this case, particularly because it doesn't fall under Conway, where the evidence where was actually offered at trial.
And before you go on, what other options exist in a case where a trial court concludes that the police wrongfully destroyed evidence? What other options short of dismissal are there?
Well, I mean, what trial counsel argued in this case was that it should go to the weight. He argued that, look, the fact that this was destroyed is something that the trial court ought to consider as the weight in the evidence in this case, and the trial court did consider that.
In a jury trial setting, could the court have an adverse inference as a sanction?
I think that, I'm not sure what you mean by that, Your Honor, but I do think...
Like a spoliation inference.
I think that that there could be an instruction in a jury trial for spoliation that's not required. Required here because it was a bench trial. And I want to make a couple of comments before I think I've kind of moved out, unfortunately, of the Youngblood versus Youngblood Trombetta arena, but I do want to make a couple of comments. And one is that the record here, I would say that, you know, the fact that the defendant says he knows that this evidence would have exculpated him, there was no testimony regarding that he knows that this evidence would have exculpated him. I don't believe that counsel's comments were a proffer of that. That occurred during argument. There was no evidence presented to the trial court regarding these policies. In fact, the only thing before the trial court was The Commonwealth's proffer that it was done pursuant to policy, and although there may be some question about, and there is a good reason not to get into these policies, and the reason is, and I couldn't, you know, put on a police officer here in the appellate court or anyone to testify about what these policies are or the fact that this was originally charged as a misdemeanor and then was null prost and then was, I believe, then directly indicted, which complicated the destruction policies in this case.
The other issue is even if it's in the, before the court, I mean, the fact that that an agency doesn't follow its own policies doesn't necessarily mean bad faith as opposed to negligence.
That's absolutely true, and that in, under Gaglionia and many of the other cases, and I cited a number from other jurisdictions, which talk about what is necessary for bad faith, and of course that alone is not adequate to prove bad faith. So I would ask the court not to find the ends of justice here and reach the bad faith argument. There was no grave injustice or any constitutional error that has been proven, and it is the appellant's burden to prove the constitutional violation. The evidence, as I've argued, was not apparently exculpatory. There was no evidence seen. There was no video seen. There was no evidence anybody had ever viewed this video. We don't know which way the cameras were facing. The fact that sometime after the fact, the two officers, much later after the fact, recalled things slightly differently does not mean that that video would have been apparently exculpatory because they don't know what the other ones were calling, and the passage of time may have affected that, and the way that the camera was aimed may have affected that, and the place that they were, their vantage points in the vehicle may have affected that. So that is not evidence that it was apparently exculpatory. This argument about the fact that Trombetta, Youngblood, Fisher. I would also say that in Fisher, there's definitely the fact that there's a discovery order in place does not mean bad faith. They specifically said that in Fisher. And so that should not detain this court. And the argument that the Youngblood, Trombetta standards only apply to physical evidence is not well taken because I've cited the court to numerous other cases in which exactly dash cam videos there is no legitimate were considered not apparently exculpatory. The further testing that videos or audio tapes are subjected to is actually being able to view it and see what's on there. That's the further testing. There's not a special standard with regard, a special constitutional standard with regard to physical evidence only. With regard to a Brady violation, there's been no evidence that the videotapes were exculpatory. There was no evidence that it was material. We don't know what was on there. I think I've already covered Rule 3A11 on the sufficiency question. I think fair inferences from the testimony was that the officers saw this defendant driving. There was testimony, the only issue I think that was raised was his identification. There was testimony he was wearing certain clothing, had tattoos, had a hat. The way the questions were asked, the word defendant, Mr. Harrell's car were in the questions. Certainly the court could have inferred from that was an identity of the fact that these officers saw Mr. Harrell driving that car because that's the way the question was asked, and those were the answers that were given. Then there was a short time later, Mr. Harrell was found sitting in an area close by, heavy breathing, with a trail of garbage leaving from where the car was found, and things as if he had emptied his pockets. A canine also, as further corroborating evidence, alerted along that same path and corroborated the officer's testimony and the court's reasonable inference in this case that it was the Mr. Harrell who was driving this vehicle.
Mr. Point, if I may, in regard to the identification issue, did they also confirm that in terms of the neck tattoo and the clothing items that he was that they observed in the driver of the vehicle that he wore those same items when they saw him.
Yeah, they said, I think the testimony was with the hat and the shirt and the tattoo, which the court could have inferred was the same from that testimony, was the same tattoo, hat, and shirt that they had just testified about. I'm happy to answer any further questions, but I see I'm out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just ask that you affirm.
Ms. Shapiro, you have the remainder of your time left. Given that we asked you so many questions, we give it 4 minutes.
I very much appreciate that, Your Honor. I want to try to quickly address two main points here. First, this panel can sidestep a lot of these issues, Gavilonia, the bad faith inquiry, the question of whether the tapes could be apparent exculpatory evidence, by resolving the case on the Brady claim. Brady has a different standard. Brady requires only timely disclosure of material information. There's no bad faith required. And the case law defines material in this way. The constitutional error occurs, quote, if the evidence is material in the sense that its suppression undermines confidence in the outcome of the trial. That comes from the Virginia case of Workman, quoting U.S. precedent Brett Bagley. It requires another framing in Workman is, the question is not whether the defendant would have more likely than not received a different verdict with the evidence, but whether in its absence he received a fair trial understood as a verdict worthy of confidence. The verdict here is not worthy of confidence because something fundamentally went wrong those tapes were destroyed.
Shapiro, I think in reciting the Brady standard, you left out that it has to be exculpatory.
The way that Workman discusses the Brady standard is to state that there has to be a timely disclosure of material information helpful to the defendant, also framed as, and continues with the quotes that I just read. There is a requirement that the information be helpful to the defendant. That's implied, I believe, implied by the quotes that I read. But there's a lot of reason to find that the evidence here was material. In addition to the points that I made earlier when answering Your Honor's question about the exculpatory value of the evidence, the nature of these tapes specifically, the proffer that was made by defense counsel, I mentioned briefly that these tapes would have served valuable rebuttal and impeachment evidence for the defense.
You don't know that because you don't know what was on the tape. It might not have shown anything because it might have been obstructed by clothing.
At the very least, Your Honor, the tapes would have established that essential timeline that I discussed before. How long the car was
I just don't see how you get from there to saying that that would have been exculpatory.
The reason that that would have been exculpatory, Your Honor, is because the Commonwealth, and here in argument, the Attorney General's office as well, relies heavily on the idea that Mr. Harrell was found on the porch, out of breath. They bring up the fact that there was a canine. Just as a small point of error, there was no alert from the canine, and that's just discussed in our briefing. That evidence was very, very low, if any value at all. All of the circumstantial evidence in this case would have been refuted by the timeline in those videos, even if they didn't show.
It could have been confirmed by the videos. You don't know.
Your Honors, that is the crux of this problem. It certainly is. But a person who is wrongfully accused of a crime, when the police destroy videos of the crime, after a discovery order has been entered, they have to have some constitutional remedy. And if Trombetta and Youngblood can't be the remedy, then Brady has to be the remedy.
I don't think we quarrel with you that it's not a good thing that the police lost this evidence. That's clearly a bad thing. The question is, what's the right remedy? And if I understand Ms. Bourne's argument correctly, your defense counsel did not ask for a remedy in this case short of dismissal. Is that right? Like, there's no adverse inference, for example, was requested.
There is no remedy short of dismissal that could cure the problem here. And that's the short answer there. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, counsel, for your argument. That concludes the arguments for today's docket. We adjourn.